Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Paul Teed, a member of the Society and a Professor of History at Saginaw Valley State University. He's going to be talking to us today about what history means to him and why it matters. Hello, Paul. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hi, Barry. It's nice to be here.
Okay, Paul. I'd like to start off by asking you to tell us something of your background and basically how you ended up joining the Society.
Sure. Well, I'm from the East Coast of the United States originally. I'm originally from Connecticut. I grew up in the 1970s and 80s. I was brought up in the Congregational Church tradition, which is a sort of a liberal Protestant tradition. My grandfather was a Congregational minister, and I gravitated toward academic life. There were a series of questions that as a young person I was very interested in, and I came to believe that an academic life would help me to pursue answers to them.
Yeah.
And I attended New York University in New York City in the 1980s and received my bachelor's degree from there and then my master's and PhD from the University of Connecticut. And throughout that whole period, one of the things that remained with me was a kind of an aversion, I guess you might say, to any form of dogmatic certainty, yeah. Whether it was theories of social science or religious dogmatism, I sort of had struggled with that, and of course, living in the United States these days, we have a culture that is in many ways so polarized by dogmatic certainties,
mm-hmm.
And so I began to explore various alternatives to that way of thinking and that way of being, and I found my way to the books of Stephen Batchelor, who has written about, as I'm sure you know, books like Buddhism Without Beliefs or Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist, and it was from Stephen Batchelor's thinking that I found the Middle Way Society and was quite pleased and quite struck by how similar the values of the Middle Way Society were to what I had been kind of thinking about and struggling with for so long.
Okay. Well, let's move on now to the main topic of the talk. How do you define history in the broad sense?
Right. That's a complex and I think fascinating question. Not being a philosopher, but rather being a practical or a practicing historian, I guess I come at it from a background of experience with actually doing history. But I would say that history is really an attempt to interpret the past through the use of documentary evidence. I tend to be wary of definitions of history that are too deterministic, that say that history is the past, or you know, sort of implying that we can, in some direct, unmediated way, understand the past. Really, I think history, you know, as a practicing historian, I think it's important to start from the point of a point of humility and understanding that we have to understand and interpret the past through the surviving documentary evidence, and that often there's great limitations in terms of what we can know about the past.
Yeah.
So I would say that my broad definition is that it's an interpretation or an attempt to interpret the past through the use of existing documents, although in understanding what documents mean, you know, that can be understood quite broadly, not just written documents, but also art and music. And there are many historians who also use archaeological sources, the study of material culture, but it's an interpretive discipline rather than, I would say, a strictly factual discipline. That's sort of the way I understand how historians function. And having practiced history for a long time, I now am perhaps even more humble than I was when I started about what can be known directly about the past.
Okay. I suppose in relation to that perspective, one aspect of Middle Way philosophy is the understanding that people have objectivity and not our theories. and this objectivity is incremental by nature, just like we say, come on, be a bit more objective. So how does this tie in with your concept of objectivity in relation to history?
Well, I would say that when I was in graduate school in the 1980s and early 1990s, there were many sort of theoretical constructs that we as graduate students were introduced to or encouraged to use in studying the past. One of them was, of course, Marxist theory. Another was sort of behaviorist understandings of history. And in many ways, those theories contained a level of determinism with which I was not very comfortable, although because I was encouraged to use them when I approached the past in my early graduate work, I attempted to apply those theories in one way or another to my understanding of the past. And while they were in some respects quite fruitful, one of the things I noticed as I approached the evidence is that nearly all, if not all, of the theoretical constructs that I was attempting to use tended to break down when I approached the past and human beings acting in the past. They tended to break down at the level of individual experience.
Yeah.
And for good or ill, what I ended up doing because of that was I became more and more convinced that what I was studying was experience itself and the indeterminate nature of human experience. And so my dissertation was actually a biographical study of a 19th century American anti-slavery activist. And I was very interested in figuring out why he came to the anti-slavery, what drove him to come to the anti-slavery movement. And, you know, the more that I studied him, and in the case of Theodore Parker, who I looked at, there's a huge amount of evidence, thousands and thousands of letters, detailed journals and diaries. There was no real dearth of evidence, but it became very clear to me that there was no theoretical construct that was going to allow me to kind of pin down in some naively objective way exactly what led him to make what was a very risky decision to become part of an unpopular and radical movement, that I had to get into the level of sort of day-to-day experience. And so I think that, you know, what I have learned in studying the past is that objectivity comes through a constant openness to documents and the world that they open up, that really a theoretical or, if you will, metaphysical starting point is really, it can be helpful, but I think it tends to break down when you begin to encounter actors in the past.
So in a sense, did you feel that you developed a relationship with this person, that there was almost a conversation between you, or am I taking that too far?
I don't think that's going too far at all. When you read, you know, thousands of letters, and when you read journals that, I mean, the journals that Theodore Parker kept in Boston, he was born in 1810 and died in 1860, and he was a theologian, a very radical theologian. He liked to describe himself as the best hated man in America because of his rather unorthodox approach to traditional Christian theology. And his diaries really showed me the kind of inward personal struggle that he went through in trying to deal with the very negative response to much of what he was writing. I think you see some of that same kind of struggle in Charles Darwin, for example, who understood, I think, that what the ideas that he was developing were going to open up controversy and that he would be the subject of some hostility. So in the case of Parker, I was seeing that, and it is very much a kind of personal relationship. But one of the tricky parts of that, I think, is that you have to step back a little bit from the person that you're studying, even though you are involved in a kind of relationship with them, in order to not become sort of captive to their view of the world, if that makes sense.
It does, yeah. So we're sort of touching on the field of ethics here, but by what standards should we judge what makes good or better history as opposed to poor or worse history?
Yes, and that's such an important question because, you know, in the world that we live in, there are obviously, there's a huge amount of printed material available on historical subjects. We also see large numbers of now sort of commercially driven documentaries that are produced on television. In the United States, we have the History Channel, which contains all sorts of claims about the past. But in the case of working with students, it's very important to develop some way of judging or evaluating historical claims without assuming that there's some absolute notion of objectivity that as human beings we're capable of arriving at. But I think that one of the most basic ways to determine what is good or bad history is what the sources are that are being employed.
Yeah.
I teach students to look at, even though they're somewhat resistant at times, to look very closely at the footnotes of the books they're reading to see whether the claims are based in any kind of actual contact with documentary sources. I also think that when you're reading a work of history, if we're talking about the printed version here, that it's very reassuring to me when I read historical works where the author is actually willing to acknowledge his or her limitations, his or her, you know, particular vantage point or theoretical point of origin in looking at the past. I'm very reassured when I read historians who are open about the limits of what can be known about the subject that they are dealing with. One of the problems, I think, with documentaries, not all, but with many documentaries, things that are commercially produced, is that we're taken through the subject by a kind of omniscient narrator, that there's often a reenactment that is done as if we are as if we are looking somehow through a time machine at the past without an acknowledgement of the fact that what we are seeing is an interpretive construct. So I would say that the two basic things, and there's a lot of ways to do this, but two basic ways, I think, is to, first of all, to really ask some questions about what documentary basis these claims about the past are constructed from, and then a willingness of the writer or producer to recognize the limitations of what can be known about the subject.
On the subject of limitations, I suppose one of the most basic constraints with which any historian begins is the mere fact of being situated in time and space. You know, from the current time, one does not have a time-neutral perspective. Do you have, from your own experience as an academic, any strategies that you use that have been helpful in that regard?
Well, it is so important. I think one of the insights of postmodern thought is that what we know is a product in many ways of where we stand. I don't know that there is a perfect way to guard against that except a certain kind of awareness of the fact of it. So that, you know, when I was studying Theodore Parker, or right now, for example, I'm writing, along with my wife, I'm writing a book on the Reconstruction period that followed the American Civil War. One of the things that I have tried to do and that we're trying to do as we write this book is to be aware of the tradition of historical writing about the topic.
Yes.
And so, for example, in the case of the Reconstruction period following the Civil War, there has been a very long and controversial tradition of literature that has approached this subject from all sorts of different angles. But one of the things, for example, that has come through to me as we've done the research on that book is that, you know, most approaches to the topic have focused pretty exclusively on a political narrative. They've looked at this through the lens of, you know, what Congress was doing, what the president was doing, or perhaps what the military was doing. And that, you know, one of the things that's really, you know, opened the period up is that we have begun to look at the past in this case of Reconstruction, from the perspective of African Americans, who of course were newly emancipated and were struggling with the realities of life in the South after the American Civil War, and the awareness of how one's perspective or how one's understanding of a period alters. Based on sort of the lens that you're using to examine it, is something that I think the only way that you can guard against that or perhaps guard against it is too negative a way mm-hmm. of describing it. I think it actually can be a quite strikingly creative aspect of looking at a period, to be aware of where you're standing. But I think it's the awareness that you stand in a particular place and are examining a period or a person or a tradition or what have you from a particular lens is perhaps the best way to guard against exaggeration or some more grandiose claim than really is warranted by the evidence.
Well, that makes sense, Paul. What did you think of 12 Years a Slave?
Well, I'm so glad that you asked me about 12 Years a Slave because obviously it has received a great deal of attention. And what's in my case, what's interesting is that I was first introduced to Solomon Northup and the narrative 12 Years a Slave because I taught for 2 years in South Louisiana at a branch campus of Louisiana State University. Before I came to Saginaw, after I got my PhD, I went and taught for 2 years in South Louisiana. And one of my colleagues there knew that I was teaching a course on early American history and suggested that I use what at the time was a little-known slave narrative. In the 1990s, much more famous slave narratives were written by Frederick Douglass, for example, or a slave woman named Harriet Jacobs. Those were the most famous narratives that were assigned in most college classrooms.
Uh-huh.
12 Years a Slave was not very well known. And so I read it and was absolutely bowled over by the power of the narrative. Here was a free man who was tricked and kidnapped and sold into slavery. It was really a striking narrative. So I've been assigning that book to classes. My wife also assigns it. She's also a professor at Saginaw Valley. She's assigned it as well for years. And so when we found out that it was being made into a movie, we were both very excited. We went to see the film. We also read or listened to interviews with the director and some of the actors. And in many ways, it is an amazing film. I think it is better than many, many films that deal with American slavery. I think there aren't very many films that deal forthrightly with the history of slavery in the United States. The film Amistad is one exception to that. Mm-hmm. And this film very, very much deals forthrightly with the film. And one of the things that it's very good at is showing the terrible violence of slavery.
Yeah.
And I think it deals very forthrightly with it. The only criticism I have of the film is that it tends to describe slaveholders almost as psychopaths. In other words, one of the main characters is Edwin Epps, who owns Solomon Northup. Northup works for him as a slave for much of the time that he's enslaved in Louisiana. And in the film, Epps is described as sort of a psychopathic figure. He's horrifically violent. In the narrative, Edwin Epps is not a psychopath. He's a slaveholder. He's particularly brutal. He's often violent. But I think one of the risks that we run when we describe slaveholders as psychopaths, as Epps is, I think, that's the way I interpret the description of him in the film, is that we run the risk of not understanding that violence was actually part of the everyday reality of slavery.
Yeah, I can relate to that very much. He was a bit like a cardboard cutout in a way, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But just changing the subject slightly, but I think relatedly, I don't know if you've ever seen the film Downfall, about the last few days of Hitler's time in the bunker. And what was really powerful about that film, they showed Hitler as being kind to his staff and liking his dog. And they showed also that he was had some very dysfunctional and views and was very brutal. They also showed him as a human being, which in fact made it more chilling because you could, in a sense, identify with him to an extent. And I think maybe the point you're making is that with this guy that was as a psychopath, you couldn't really relate to him as another human being in a way.
I think that's exactly That's exactly right. I mean, I have read, in just doing research on this period, I've read the letters of slaveholders, and while, of course, the institution of slavery was a horrifically violent and brutal and horrible system, they were regular human beings practicing it, and I think that the way to understand slavery, you know, in a more nuanced way, and maybe a way that does more justice to the actual day-to-day experience, is that, you know, the slaveholders meted out violence as a matter of course. They rarely questioned it. It didn't take a psychopath, you know, to be a brutal and violent slaveholder. It was part and parcel of the everyday way in which the system worked. And I think, yes, that Epps comes across in the film as a cardboard cutout. I think that's a very good way of describing it. So that's my only criticism of the film. I think there were many other very, very good elements of the film, particularly the way in which it describes the special problems that enslaved women faced on plantations in the South.
Yeah, they were between a rock and a hard place, weren't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah. How much, when you are teaching history, is it about telling a story?
Well, I do tend to be somewhat more traditional in my pedagogical methods in the classroom, because I do lecture quite a bit in my classes. One of the trends these days in higher education, at least in the U.S., maybe true in Britain as well, is to use sort of group projects or group work in the classroom. And I do some of that, because I do think it helps students to, particularly if you're working with original sources from the period, to kind of try to work through those. But I do tend to lecture, and my lectures do have a kind of narrative element to them. And so I do tell stories, and I try to, as much as possible, through the use of stories, I try to bring out the everyday reality, the day-to-day experiences of people in the past, so that they can be understood, you know, as human beings. And so I focus a lot on motivation, and the consequences of action, how people adjusted their beliefs in relation to experiences. And I think stories are a way to bring that element of the past, and students, I think, relate to that very well. When they begin to see through the telling of story that the people they're studying are flesh and blood human beings like themselves, history becomes less abstract and, I think, more personal and more real.
Yeah.
So I think that history is about telling stories. It's just always important, and I do this whenever I tell stories in my classes, is to always be aware that the story that you're telling is not the only story that could be told about the subject you're examining.
Yeah.
So I'll use words in my classes like, oh, I would argue, or from my experience with the sources of this period, I would say. So I try always to be very open and honest about the limits of the particular narrative that I'm telling. But I do believe that narrative and the telling of stories can be a very important tool in helping students to understand interpretation of the past.
Well, finally, Paul, you've touched on the idea of provisionality there. What is your understanding of the middle way, and how does it relate to what we've been talking about today?
Yes. Well, I would say, to me, my understanding of the middle way is I guess, fairly simple, in the sense that it is the avoidance of dogmatic extremes. And the ways in which dogmatic extremes, when human beings embrace them, distort reality.
Yeah.
And that those distortions of reality sometimes lead to human actions that can be terribly destructive. And I think that, you know, we see this in many ways. We see this in fundamentalist religion. We see it in the ways in which political ideology can often distort reality, sometimes even intentionally distort reality, which of course leads to various forms of polarization and ways of seeing other people as somehow less than fully human. So to me, the middle way is an avoidance of extreme dogmatic positions, a kind of humility when it comes to any forms of metaphysical assertion or certainty.
Yeah.
And it's a certain kind of openness to new experience, or a willingness to modify existing belief in light of experience. And I think that history, there's a lot of places in the past where you can see the results of dogmatic certainty. So much of human conflict, I think, in the past has been generated by dogmatic certainties, whether it's about nationalism, whether it's about religion, whether it's about economic systems, or what have you. I think that you see the danger that often dogmatic certainty or metaphysical certainty can create. So for me, history is a very powerful tool in reinforcing the importance of openness to experience and a kind of a critical attitude toward dogmatic or metaphysical certainties.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Paul. It's been really interesting today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
You can find out more about Middleway philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.